Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in the Indian Ocean World, a podcast series on the New Books Network. This podcast is for listeners who want to sail the waters of the expansive Indian Ocean and learn about its past and present. Thank you for joining me today. I'm your host, Ahmed Al-Mazmi from Princeton University. Today I'm here to talk to Professor Chaya Goswami, the author of Globalization Before Its Time, The Gujarati Merchants from Kutch, published by Penguin Books in 2016. Chaya Goswami is the head of the history department at SK Somaiya College, Mumbai in India. She specializes in the maritime history of South Asia, the Western Indian Ocean. She has authored the award-winning book by the Indian History Congress, The Call of the Sea, Kutch Traders in Muscat and Zanzibar between 1800s and 1880, published by Orient Black Swan in 2011. Her current research project focuses on maritime trade and piracy in the Gulfs of Kutch and Persia between 1650 and 1820. By discussing globalization before its time, we will explore how did the Kutchi traders build on the Gujarat advantage. In the 18th and the early 20th centuries, during the dying days of the Mughal Empire, merchants from Kutch established a flourishing overseas trade, building on a rich legacy of free trade in pre-modern times between the many ports of Gujarat and the Middle East. The Kutchis dealt in pearls, dates, spices, and ivory with the faraway lands of Muscat and Zanzibar. The Kutchi merchants behaved much like today's venture capitalists. They knew how to grow capital, seek new markets, and create them where they didn't exist. They also had a phenomenal risk appetite. What they were able to practice was nothing less than the traits of globalization before its time, as this book argues. Welcome, Chaya, to New Books in the Indian Ocean World, and thanks so much for taking the time to talk about your book today.
Thank you, Emma. Thank you very much for the opportunity also.
Thank you. We would like to get to know the author first. If you can say a few words about yourself, where you grew up, where you went to school, how you became interested in the history of Kutch and Gujarat, and trade and the Indian Ocean world, and if you had any scholars and mentors that shaped and influenced your career.
Well, I grew up in a suburb of Mumbai called Mulund and completed my schooling in a Gujarati medium school, namely Sheth Motibhai Panchan Rashtriya Shala. I was the first one in my family to pass the 10th grade exam conducted by the Maharashtra State Board. And in my school days itself, history as a subject caught my attention. I have a vivid memory of watching a thrilling movie on Shivaji, the founder of the Maratha Kingdom, when I was in a grade 4 itself. So it certainly left a deep mark on my tender mind as I got attracted to reach such engrossing kind of narratives of the past. Thereafter, the lessons on the world wars and the Indian national movement caught my fancy. Resultantly, I ended up liking all my history teachers at school, irrespective of how they taught. Now, this passion fortunately continued during my undergraduate studies in the Vazhe College of Mulund and my amazing college teachers, namely Dr. Preeta Nilesh and Dr. Sonali Pednekar, captivatingly taught the histories of the Far East and America, respectively. Now, with this strong foundation, when I joined my master's class in history, my love for the subject knew no bounds. Though most of the master courses I studied on my own, the course on British constitutional history and Dr. Mariam Dosil, who taught me that course, brought a significant change in my learning journey. In fact, I developed a sweet bond with her as I at times offered her chocolates before the classes started. And by being her regular student, I managed to drew her attention out of the 100-odd students. Though somehow I could complete my master's, my journey ahead was never that easy. In fact, it was difficult during the master's day for my mom said enough to the studies and insisted on getting me married. Because by then, according to the Kachi or you can say Gujarati societal norms, I was already late in getting married. For a year, I was upgrading my cooking skills. I made sketches, did some kind of knitting and all the other works which would have made me a homemaker, but not a historian. But destiny had other plans, perhaps. Once in a casual conversation over my future studies to Dr. Dosal, I referred to her how being a Kachi, I have some inbuilt limitations. Dr. Dosal, who being herself a half Kachi, convincingly advised me to pursue either MPhil or PhD on Kutch, as very little research was done by then. So again, convincing my mother became a task. She said, I don't approve the idea, but if you wish to do it on your own independently. Fortunately, I had saved some money for my birthday celebration and that was my first investment in pursuing PhD with full enthusiasm and conviction. Despite all her concerns about my marriage, my mom quite happily accompanied me in my visits to Kutch and Ahmedabad for the field research. So she played definitely instrumental role. Dr. Mariam Dosal, who became my research supervisor, became my mentor all too, as she suggested me to review a book on Kutch by Rushbrook Williams and also select articles on the socio-economic history of India and insisted spending a longer time in the archives. Thereafter, there was no looking back. And till date, the date with the Maharashtra State Archives continues. Well, my story so far, you know, highlights how I was initiated to research. But when it comes to selecting the subject of research, structuring the research, methodology, or even writing, it was all fixed by me. And I did not receive any formal training on closely studying maritime Indian Ocean, because my courses of postgraduate studies were different. And so it purely depended on how I went ahead with it. Quite unconventional journey of doing research I covered. Not certainly the way the foreign universities or the leading universities of India such as JNU tutor or coach their PhD candidates. For instance, I couldn't get hold over Abdul Sharif's book. So like, you know, those limitations I had when I was doing PhD and funding was also not available. So, but anyways, I have very interesting link with the Princeton University. I want to refer here. I am so tempted to share with you and can't resist. May I?
Sure, yeah.
So when I reached the writing stage, my supervisor was awarded a senior fellowship by the Princeton University. Though it was a happy news, it stressed me as I wanted to submit my dissertation that year. Dr. Dosal told me to hurry up on the process of writing. I did speed up on writing and completed the drafts. But by then, it was her time to go to Princeton. As a solution, she told me to post her the final draft of the dissertation to her Princeton office address. And I think if I remember correctly, it was around the fall of 2002, I posted her the spiral-bounded dissertation. And thus, years ago, my dissertation was read and approved in the campus of Princeton. Before its final submission in December 2002. After around 18 years, you emailed me to give this interview. And one of the reasons to say yes to it is this, because this unusual small story behind it.
Oh, that's fascinating. Thank you so much for sharing these intimate stories and encounters that really shaped your journey. And I'm sure many listeners would relate to that. We'd like to talk about your book now. Globalization Before Its Time, as a book idea, how did it develop? And what was the research process like and the writing experience? And would you say that this book connects or departs from your first book, The Call of the Sea, Kutchi Traders of Muscat and Zanzibar, in what ways?
So this idea of the book straight away came from Gurusharan Das, who had conceptualized a business history series titled Story of the Indian Business in the non-fiction category with Penguin Books. And he had first approached my supervisor, who by then was doing her long pending research on Kutch. But knowing very well that my first book was already underway on the business history of Kutch, she recommended my name for the series. Following up from there, I sent a draft proposal to Gurusharan Das. Since I was writing for Penguin, the writing experience was stressful from the beginning. And in the entire exercise of giving more than what was already getting published, I was kind of under pressure. Additionally, the reviewer's suggestions were quite thought-provoking but demanding too. Resultantly, I ended up crossing the set word limit of 50,000 to around 100,000 words. Imagine my plight. Because I had challenges of the early motherhood and fending all the odds sitting on the floor when I wrote and wrote. The journey was already trying in nature because we had shifted then. So our house was also not in good shape by then. So all the time writing at home was also not possible. So I searched out a local library. It was quite a disgusting space filled with filth and quite noisy too. However, I had no choice because I couldn't afford to waste my time in commuting. So it was indeed a time of solitary and had left no space to personal or social life. And yet, writing this book, I thoroughly enjoyed. For I realized that how there are interesting narratives constructed around the commodity exchange. I was transported to different spaces and material cultures, came closer to dates trade and America's Thanksgiving culture, Victorian houses and story of pianos and ivory, arms trade and European works, which manufactured Martini Khan, pearls and Bombay Bazaar, merchants from Salem, Marche, Hamburg, clove orchards, gum copal trees of the mainland Zanzibar, and above all, a fascinating deep Indian Ocean and Kutchi entrepreneurs and seafarers. So this is how, you know, the whole process became so enjoyable. This question that how this book differed from the previous one did bother me greatly, as the challenge was huge to offer something new to the series, and Penguin's reputation had already built up the pressure, as I said. So my sweet dilemma was, how am I going to retain the importance of both the books? One by then was in the press and other was peer reviewed by Gurusharan Das and Lakshmi Subramanian. In fact, their suggestions made a huge difference. I greatly changed the perspective. Yet a puzzling question was, what's new in the book? Because I cannot reproduce what's already there in the first books. I think it rarely happens to the authors that they get back-to-back opportunities of writing on the same subject. Anyways, taking up the challenge, I went up, I went back to the archives and the Asiatic Society of Mumbai to recheck if I had left any records on the Kutchis unconsulted, and their trading enterprise has something new to offer. And when I was still not satisfied, then it occurred to me that I have had not much written on the pearls and dates in the story of Kutchis in Muscat. I immediately then ended up contacting Vimal Purecha, the descendant of Ratan Sri Purushottam, to consult his family records on Ratan Sri Purushottam. And these documents were compiled by Dr. Calvin Allen, and he promptly sent me the scans of it. So he was quite generous in sharing this with me. And my confidence level built up, and in the meanwhile, I flew to Canada to attend an IOWC-organized conference on textile at McGill University to meet the expectations of the scholarly audience. I presented an interesting paper on textile of Kutch and East African market. This paper helped me to explore the contesting textile market of Zanzibar built around Kaniki and Merikani. I also expanded the scope of writing on ivory, gum copal, cloves, and foreign firms. So with this touch of redoing the research and rewriting, I managed to bring a desired amount of difference between the two books. A digest on local customs in Gujarati and Professor Berensi's book helped me greatly in building up the novelty in the first chapter. So then I consider writing on various sub-themes like marine insurance or language of the business, which I had either cursorily kind of referred or not included in the first book. I continued to talk about the mercantile firms I have had already referred in my first book, and yet I rewrote and expanded upon, for instance, Ratan Sree Purushottam and his arms trade. And the writing style was customized to circulate the readership to the lay readers. So that was also a difference from the first book.
The book definitely is quite accessible and quite grabbing in its prose, which makes it really an enjoyable read. Turn now to the book and its chapters. The book is divided in four chapters with an introduction and a conclusion. In the introduction by Gurcharan Jas, we learn about the Gujarati or the Gujarat advantage, the pre-modern free trade in the Indian Ocean, the violent mercantile age, and the story of Indian business. How would you situate Gujarat and see its early mercantile history prior and post to the Portuguese arrival? And what do you mean by, or what does Das means by the Gujarat advantage?
Okay, so since time immemorial, Gujarat with its long coastline was the active participant in the trade of the Arabian Sea. Its maritime past has interesting nuggets of information on some of the ports. To start with, both Ptolemy and Pericles mention about Bharuch as a premier port, which ended up stretching the trading network to the Red Sea zone, especially Socotra. For around five centuries of the CE period, the epigraphic and archaeological evidence attest the preponderance of Bharuch in Socotra, and after it, Khambhat, that is known in the English sources as Cambay, cornered much of the maritime trade. In the background of the western seaboard of the subcontinent, the primacy of Stambha Tirtha or Khambayat or Cambay as a port and its impressive hinterland and foreland are, you know, kind of important ideas to note. And the theory of the feeder ports like Somnath, Goga, Sanjan, and the shapes up here as these ports contributed to the preeminence of Cambay. The contributory factor was the agrarian prosperity in Gujarat. The Gujarati ports indeed acquired prime spot and became the focal point not only for the exchange of commodities but also for the cultural transactions. The Jewish Geniza records, consulted by Professor Ranbir Chakravarti in India and others who have published it, show how Gujarati trading network with Malabar and the Red Sea was reciprocal and substantive. Alongside, these two features in the record suggesting its trading interaction with Aden. So the leads derived from the Jewish records prompt the scholars to comprehend the complexity of the interport connectivity. However, Bharuch continued to be the port of importance, but no longer, you know, the port-to-port transfer theory can be the only way to see the Gujarat's progress as far as maritime trading network was concerned. And in fact, more than Khambhat, Beras, that is Bharuch, is referred in the Jewish trading network stretching from the Red Sea to Gujarat. So, you know, traditionally what is the notion is that, okay, after Bharuch, Khambhat rose in importance. But the Ganesha records are suggesting that Bharuch stayed on. Khambhat, no doubt, Cambay was always, of course, an important port once, you know, it was noted for its trading network. But overall, anyways, when we talk about what Gujarat provided was the shipping network, trading network, financial circularity and market. So, interfaces of exchange system were the with the foreland and feeder ports, and with the coming of the Portuguese, the tone of aggressiveness at sea set in across the Western Indian Ocean. So, their focus shifted from southwest coast to the western coast of India. So, here also there is a change, right? Because the Portuguese are now entering the maritime scene of Gujarat. So, two of the ports like Diu and Daman, the Portuguese won it from the Sultan of Gujarat, Bahadur Shah, through a treaty of Basin. And it became their base in Gujarat. And they capitalized on Gujarat advantage when their trade with Mozambique and East Africa. And later on, Surat as a Mughal port emerged quite strong. So this was quite an aggressive phase as the pirates from the western coast did not let the Portuguese settle down easily. Now this particular narrative is still awaited to be told. And Gujarati entrepreneurs from Diu and Surat actively participated in the growing commerce of the Portuguese East Africa. Merchants especially from Diu utilized the Portuguese connection from India and were actively engaged in the commerce of Mozambique and Swahili coast, making products of Gujarat very popular and which fairly continued to dominate the import trade of East Africa throughout the 17th century. Similarly, the commodities of East Africa form the important component in the import trade of Diu, which is evident from the fact that manufacturing industries at Diu in the textile production, ivory and tortoise shell carving and gold work increased in great numbers, about which Edward Alpers refers in his work. And due to the changing political order as a result of successful Omani inroads into the Swahili coast during the second half of the 18th century, trade between Gujarat, Arabia and East Africa underwent a significant transformation. So this is how, you know, we can link the pre-Portuguese and Portuguese history till the 18th century. And in so happening, the Portuguese intervention in the early 16th century in the Asian trade paved way to new patterns, which emerged after the rise of British in India and the Omani Arabs on the Swahili coast. So, the stage was set by then. As far as the merchants and their profiles are concerned, be it Shantidas Zaveri, his son Khushal Das, Purushottam Das or Dayal Das from Ahmedabad, Abdul Ghafur from Surat, each one along with managing the mercantile enterprises took up the important political portfolios or contributed in shaping the state politics of pre-Portuguese and during the Portuguese times also. So, at the crucial juncture of their regional polities, these merchants also plunged deep into the political affairs, which significantly transcended the political economy of Gujarat. And in fact, I am quite excited to redraw this age imagery in my new book. So, this is how I would like to narrate the story of pre-Portuguese and Portuguese period.
Thank you for giving us this long dure perspective on the ancient trade routes from the Roman times all the way to Islamic times between Old Cairo, the Red Sea, Aden, southern India and Gujarat, and then moving all the way to the 18th century. Let's now move on and talk about the first chapter, Kutch, Land of Entrepreneurs. In this chapter, you give us introductory remarks about many things, such as the mercantile communities and the Mahajan, politics and trade, migrations, the rise and fall of Mandvi, the horse trade, the sailing traditions, and so on. How did trade and markets develop initially in Kutch and Gujarat, as you alluded to in the long durée, but specifically during the 18th and 19th century? And how was it connected to the rest of Eurasia, if you talk about the hinterlands, but also across the Indian Ocean?
Well, I like this question of yours, and it made me think and think more on the market perspective and how the linkages were, stretched beyond the borders of the Indian Ocean, and then, across the Indian Ocean and Eurasian hinterland. So through diverse trajectories, the trade and market developed in Gujarat and Kutch. Largely, caravan trading network connected to the umland of Marwar and Pali with the Kutch coast enriched the long distance trade network with the Western Indian Ocean. Then there is another second kind of, network, which is developing because of the intra-Gulf of Kutch interaction, that is south of Gulf of Kutch and north of Gulf of Kutch. This makes Kutch and Kathiawar geographically. And their intra-Gulf interaction is also not much discussed about. So when we connect this with both the Arabian Sea and the Persian Gulf, we can see, how interactive the whole trading experience becomes. The third one was rich but overlapping inter-delta, inter-regional trade with Sindh. And the fourth was intercoastal links with Bombay and Malabar coast. I'm leaving the Eastern India right now because I just want to give some kind of a coherence to this linkages. I mean, the trade routes and the inland and hinterland connections. So all these routes and markets supplied the surplus to the Arabian and the Persian Gulf regions. For instance, Sindh was the chief supplier of grain in the Arabian Gulf, supplies on which principally Muscat depended. In the late 16th century, the most profitable trade for the Portuguese Casado established at Lahari Bandar of Sindh to Basra, Muscat and Hormuz, and upon which they made extraordinary profits. So in the Berens's work, Moko Pereira's experience is noted, and he had cruised off Muscat with the task of preventing that any small ships would cross over from Sindh, which was so that no supplies pass into the Imam's land. So, how there were these attempts to check the Sindh's connection with Muscat. So undoubtedly, the granary of Sindh critically fed both the populace of the gulfs of Kutch and Arabia. So the surging wave of mundane commodities are very important, okay? And people and commercial ideas across the geographic boundaries strengthen the integrative role of the littoral spaces. The product of Sindh and Kutch thus ensured the integration of economy of its region into the Indian Ocean economy, and it profitably strengthened the commercial position of merchants in the wider networks. The exposure of Kutch and Kathiawar to the demands of the world market caused the reorientation of their regional economy, society and settlement patterns in the 18th century towards specialized production of cotton, ivory, among many more. So the degree of integration and its impact on economies of these zones was unprecedented, and it tied up a long history of commodity specialization, which linked the adjoining regions and indirectly to more distant markets of West through an import-export trade in these specialized products. There are several parallels, between the Shikarpuri, Thattai, Kutchi, Halari, Bhatias, who successfully embedded their capital networks in the Indian Ocean credit system. So when we situate in this entire narrative, by the, Mandvi in the entire narrative, by the beginning of 18th century, you see Mandvi unquestionably emerged as a key player in cotton and textile circulation and market formation, and it had developed interlocking networks with the hinterland. So, however, the trade with East Africa changed the fortunes of Mandvi as the orbit of investment profitably expanded. So, the fortune changer commodity, of course, was ivory, and which made Kutch's economy more vibrant and monetized. And ivory from Mandvi was circulated with the hinterland trading centers of Pali and Marwar, which I've already mentioned. So these centers were Mandvi's trading partners in textile circulations also. So there was a strong nexus between the artisans and caravan merchants to bring woven fabric from Marwar and Pali. Once Surat's prominence was fading away, Mandvi took over this privileged position of repository of goods in the northern western India. And the merchants of Mandvi endeavored to establish their former control over the foreign trade. And very importantly, the trade links between Mandvi and Bombay and contours of its economic history narrates how the oceanic exchanges integrated the regional economy of Kutch to that of the Western Indian Ocean. The trans-regional trade of East Africa with Kutch was built on interwoven circuits of commerce, and which stretched up to the Red Sea and Arabia also. So in a trans-oceanic way, it winged until Europe and northeastern coast of America. Swahili coast, for instance, was frequently visited by the Arabian doves carrying the Gulf and South Asian peculiarities in exchange for ivory, slaves, spice, gum, copal. Such interport traffic engineered the trade with mainland, foreland, hinterland, and that of the sea, and thus jutted out the risk, a kind of rich cross-cultural and trans-regional trading system. In such a rich trading system, the mercantile class brought about considerable alteration in the living standards by introducing the commodities which were otherwise not possible to procure. This called for the reliance over the mercantile groups for the flow of merchandise on the customary basis. It was then the constant surge of subsistence, mundane and luxurious commodities that triggered the multi-layered expansion of the consumer and material culture, and also of market economy and money markets. So the exploration of foreign markets resultantly facilitated the greater circulation of capital and goods. The developed taste and trend of importing subsistence commodities along with the luxurious items fostered a large participation and requirement of merchants, and it also increased the bazaar power.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for sketching these broad networks across the ocean, but also across the land. In the second chapter, we move to talk about Pearl's Days and Arms, Kutchi Entrepreneurs in Muscat. In this second chapter, you sketch out the rise of Muscat, trade and settlements in the Persian Gulf, even the constitution of a little Kutch in Muscat itself. Would you like to tell us more about the Bahrain, Muscat, Kutch, Bombay axis as you describe? And how would you narrate the long 19th century of these trade networks and the advent of colonialism between the Arabian Sea and the Persian Gulf?
Interestingly, by the mid and late 18th century, the tone of 19th century trading network was set. It was the coffee trade during the late 17th and 18th centuries, and entry of Muscat and Mandvi shifted the, Muscat and Mandvi traders also and other players shifted the balance. With the entry of Bombay, it became evident that the theory of port-to-port transfer, as I have already referred, is not singularly applicable. The idea of reciprocity and interconnectedness or interlocking networks developed so in that way the long 19th century networks emerged. By then, the British brought Bombay into prominence and had extended the frontiers of their empire to the Persian Gulf. So the political correspondences in form of the diaries and volumes loudly speak about the Persian missions, treaties signed with the Muscat rulers to check the aggression of Qasimis or even Wahhabis. By the 1820s, the issue of piracy in the Persian Gulf subsided with the signing of the treaties. The British emerged as a protector to pace down the frequency of water warfare among the sheikdom during the pearl fishery season. So this was all, part of this political political game of the British, who played the sophisticated role of peacemaker between the Arab kabilas and engaged in pearl fishery with the help of powerful naval squadron. British intervention was visible in Persia, Turkey and Arabia, and they protected their commerce and merchants. And this is what the excuse they kept giving. And despite the big claims of the British, violation of maritime truce was a regular affair and made the British realize that it was not all easy to play the role of peace ambassador. However, the British were confident of positive result of their timely intervention, as they identified it as. And they took kind of actions against the sheikhs to achieve the peace during the pearl diving season. And often throughout the first half of the 19th century, the Gulf witnessed frequent collision among these sheikhs. These disturbed states of affairs negatively affected the pearl fishing business. The disputes occurred because so many boats jostled in the same in the small pearl fishery belt. So the several maritime chiefs of the littoral then entered into a maritime truce and bound themselves to the arbitrage of the English resident in the Persian Gulf. So the pearling activity had become a kind of shuttlecock of British diplomacy for the 19th century, and maritime warfare in the Persian Gulf facilitated the British diplomacy and maritime truce mainly through the subterfuge of Pax Britannica in the Persian Gulf. In fact, you know, the idea of Pax Britannica and construct, of course, imaginary construct of the British lake all emerged during this century. Government published literature in form of the selections increased during this period to potentially kind of promote the idea of their empire. Their Royal Navy and the British flag, which is known in the Gujarati literature as the Company Sarkar, had become a force. It was the time for the indigenous maritime powers, seafaring and mercantile communities to renegotiate their positioning in the Indian Ocean trading world. And some could sustain and others relegated in the margin. So this is how, you know, you can see the history of colonialism sets in. As far as pearl trade and Bahrain, Bombay, Muscat axis is concerned, it is quite interesting to note about, how the entire concept of intermediate markets and its connection with the re-exportation center and final exportation destination comes into shape with this small, tiny commodity but highly valued in its bazaars, you can say, or markets value. So Bahrain was definitely the one which was having a larger share in the pearl fishery operations. So those Sindhi Bhatias who were based in Bahrain would kind of, you know, invest their, you can say, capital in the pearl fishing operation, but their trade or their the financial networks or invisible networks were connected with Bombay and Muscat. So from both the places, they were financed. They were managing their finances. One from the Kutchi Bhatias and Khojas based in Muscat itself, and then Khojas, Bhatias, and the Parsi traders, even Jain traders from Bombay financed the trade. So there were many players in this entire pearl trade and connecting it finally to the pearl capital, as it was known by then, that is Bombay Bazaar. Because Bombay Bazaar, where Parsis and the Jain merchants played the important role in the re-exportation of it to China. So, there were different kind of markets which Bombay offered to the pearls of the Persian Gulf or the Arabian Gulf, as you would like to state.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for elucidating these networks between the Persian Gulf and Gujarat. They are fascinating in multiple ways. In the third chapter, Kutchi Enterprise in Zanzibar, we move to sub-Saharan Africa and the islands of Zanzibar to learn about Zanzibari attractions, foreign trade, and ivory, cloves, and African consumers, as well as Euro-American and Indian enterprise in Africa. In this chapter, you compare Zanzibar to Singapore or Dubai in today's world. And we learn about the magnitude of Indian Kutchi enterprise. So I would like to ask, what sort of opportunities Zanzibar offered to Kutchi and Gujarati trade networks in terms of commodities, institutions, governance, and consumerships?
Well, I would like to say numerous opportunities. For sailing over the deep ocean, these men of enterprise summarized interesting narratives of fortune, misfortune, and hope, and painted a picture of commonality. This concept was quite visible in their respective trading experiences. Ivory and other commodities changed the fortunes of some of the Bhatias and Khoja merchants and alongside the communities they belonged to. For after making the fortunes out of ivory and textile exchange, they scripted the chapter of the growth story of their respective communities in terms of building schools, hospitals, musafir khanas, rest houses, mosques, jamaat khanas, panjrapur. Panjrapur is a Gujarati word which is kind of a space to take care of the abandoned cattle, among others. Now, with benign activities such as opening the schools, hospitals, or musafir khanas, or throwing a feast, these merchants reasserted their status in the community and repeatedly secured the high status. Such social standings awakened in apprentices some kind of sublimely conscious interest and energy for matching up to their community lofty social kind of icons. And for instance, Alidana Vishram, who was also known as the Ivory King, one of the Ivory Kings, because there are others also given the same title. Tharia Topan is also given. So who did shop floor chores at Shiva Haji Paru's firm soon surpassed his employer both in controlling much of the trade of the East African interior and the philanthropy. So by examining this kind of links created by these cultural ties in tandem with the economic links provided by local trade, we do gain a clear picture of the institutional connections which foster the cohesion of regional socio-economic units. On the one hand, it placed them strongly in the bazaar economy of Bombay, for Bombay emerged as a central market to draw a huge chunk of ivory, clove, and copal. And it created re-exportation opportunities to other mercantile communities, circularities, and intersecting trading interests, invisible networks of finances, both local and foreign markets. Further, after the Civil War of America in 1860, the Bombay textile found its formidable way in the Zanzibar market. So the cotton mania of Bombay echoed strongly in Zanzibar. In 1864, the entire export amounted to, around, let's say, 427,016. Of this, were around 119,000 plus worth went to British. And in fact, to British and to British India and also to Bombay, when we count, it was around 1,100 kind of distribution. So thus, India received more than half the quantity, and Indians were enriched by providing the European merchants with a large share of remainder. So the consul of England at that time perceived that 1/20 was about the portion of trade of this place which did not pass through the hands of Indian merchants. So, most of the trade passed through them. So the Indian entrepreneurs in Zanzibar acquired most of the merchandise, and they marketed it to Zanzibar, Muscat, and India. As Bombay's share in the textile circulation in the Central and Eastern African interior increased, and it brought about a textile revolution in Bombay. This is very important to note, because the mill culture developed, which attracted investments from the Glasgow-based Scottish merchants, such as the Finlays, on whom I am currently researching, and jerked the Manchester Chamber of Commerce. Governance, barring few hindrances from the Sultan of Burgas, Sultan Burgas, Indians, it was like, facilitative in nature. Beside, custom franchise almost remained with the Kutchis. So they could play a defining role in the monetized economy of Zanzibar. What they were best at had thus a greater scope. And more specifically, their tried and tested business systems, exchanges in hundi, and commercial structures of bazaar, pedi, that is firm, animatedly highlight the mercantile milieu of Zanzibar till date. So one of the incentives for these merchants to rise in economic prominence was to gain the status in their community. So this is how it is all interlinked.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that sketching of Zanzibar trade with Gujarat and Kutch. In the fourth chapter, you bring together Oman and Zanzibar by talking about Kutchi mercantile firms. And you illustrate the business biographies of many trade households in Oman, such as the house of Bimanis, Atansi, Purshottam, the Goswamis, Kimji Ram Das, and so many others. And in Zanzibar, Shivji, Topan, Jairam Shivji, even the relationship with the American traders such as Richard Waters and others. How would you, in broad strokes, compare and contrast between the diverse historical experiences of these merchant families in Zanzibar and Oman? And what are some of their present involvements in the former trade networks?
Their relations to capital and political authorities was ambivalent, as the state loomed as a threat for many merchants, chiefly when its governors confiscated merchants' fortunes or fleeced money or overtaxed them. And it also sometimes partnered their enterprise and facilitated their commercial operations. So this is where the contrast can be noted. And their trading fortunes largely depended on the creation of transversal trading network. So as the dealers in the business of commodities, they were cleverly associated in the process of globalization and concurrently with the merchants of the West. And in most cases, they directed their own course of action, claiming the spaces of the shore and the port, the custom house and the warehouses of their own. More than that, they themselves traded these special relations, carving out a new landscape of acquaintance and pulling together dispersed localities in unforeseen and novel ways in pleasing the American clients and consumers. Besides dealing in marine and farm products of numerous varieties, they bravely plunged into the arms trade, which was fraught with high risk. So while the world order was marching on a fragile balance, it triggered by the tense relations between the Western powers, which were loudly echoed in the Asian continent, Kutchi merchants used their commercial foresight in making quick money out of the increasing demand for some of the commodities, such as arms. Though different groups and cultures in a dynamic foreign environment coexisted, the challenges of preserving identity, assimilation, and adaptation were multiple and interesting areas of investigation hitherto largely ignored would be the variegated response of Gujarati migrants to alien mercantile and cultural environments across the sea. Though in the diverse milieus of Zanzibar and Muscat, they thrived on the similar trading experiences. Historically, both these ports' economy and polities first offered the trade-centric facilitative milieus. Say, for instance, they had a greater say in the framing the economic policies or determining the currency values, and in sensitive court cases, mostly around slavery. Both the local and the British extraterritorial jurisdiction sought their intervention. And yet, the distinct experience do emerge towards the end of the 19th century when the colonial politics tightened its noose. Their historical customs control was challenged and later on robbed off, as these individual mercantile firms were politically targeted. Thriving on the former trade networks, if I have to talk about the present day some Kutchi firms, Khimji Ramdas in Muscat is still a dominant mercantile family. And however, they have diversified and plunged into a range of businesses such as heavy industries of construction and real, also in the real estates. They have also taken up the franchises of the global outlets such as Pizza Hut and others. But the but now what I hear very recently, because of the pandemic, the badly impacted economy of Muscat has somewhere left an impact, a kind of a negative impact on trading enterprise of Khimji's, who have reduced their size, their investments in the real estate. And let's see what is stored for them. But another family is quite steady since 193 years is Karimji Jivanji family and its enterprise in Zanzibar. I like the Khimjis have developed wide interest in taking up multiple franchises, Khimjis, they have also taken up this. And there are agri-businesses in the plantation products such as coffee, tea are quite impressive. And their investments are in property and automobiles, a strong legacy for philanthropy in Tanzania such as building schools, hospitals, This all is alive through the Karinji's enterprise. Karinji Clinic is there, and even hospitals are there. So providing educational scholarships, supporting local communities, that is also happening by Khinji Ramdas in Muscat. So some of the older ways of mercantile life continues, whereas the businesses have largely diversified. Even the Pawanis of Muscat, for example, had a long continuity, but very recently they are also, you know, somewhere marginalized as their financial network experiences reverses. So, and Ratanshi Purushottam's descendant Vimal Purecha and his son still live in Muscat and follow the financial business, but the size of operation is not the same as it was during the time of Ratanshi. So, this is how one can talk about the mercantile firms and their present situation. Mm-hmm.
Which really shows the resiliency and adaptability of these firms, as well as that there is a history to be written of the post-colonial trade networks in the Indian Ocean, and that the trade network of the 19th and early 20th century are not something of the past, but continue to be relevant in today's world. And many of these actors as well, interestingly, have also integrated and were nationalized in Oman as well as in East Africa as citizens of these different states, adapting new identities and new customs and new ways of identifying. Thank you so much for sharing with us the amazing world of globalization before its time. And the book, beside being a really useful introduction to the trade world in the Indian Ocean world, specifically of Gujarat and Kutch, it also includes a very extensive, useful glossary of Kutchi and Gujarati terminology, which makes it also of interest to specialists who would like to learn more about the history of trade in the region. Well, Chaya, we've taken a lot of your time, and I know you've edited a volume, which we will be talking about in the next episode, with Ned Alper's Transregional Trade and Traders Situating Gujarat in the Indian Ocean, From Early Times to 1900, published by Oxford University Press in 2019. Beside this book, what have you been working on, or what you hope to work on in the future?
Okay, so my current work is a book project on the maritime trade and piracy in the Gulf of Kutch. So after chasing the merchants, I am chasing the pirates who loved chasing the merchants. Of course, all metaphorically, I'm just saying. Initially, this research on piracy was a part of my dissertation, but I had already cast a wider net over three littoral spaces of Kutch, Muscat and Zanzibar, and the trading network which emerged out of it. So my supervisor told me to check out the chapter on piracy. Good I did that, because now I am in a better position to do justice to it with a range of sources I have consulted, including the Portuguese records. And in fact, these very records pushed the timeline of my book to 1650 as against 1780 as a start point. I had already, initially decided to research from 1780, but now I have reached to this 17th century, mid-17th century. So I am quite excited to share the kind of sources I have come across, and it would certainly add a new dimension to the historiography on the maritime aggression. And it also highlights the little known facts on the piratical culture of the Arabian Sea. So stay tuned for it. And the way, you know, it is said, God willing or inshallah, if it happens, then nothing like that. And besides that, I'm hoping to write a research paper on the Finlays, which I just mentioned. They are textile and tea enterprise in Bombay and Assam, and a book which the Bhatias want me to write on their overseas linkages. So my hands are full in this way.
They sound really exciting, and we will be looking forward to them. And thank you for following up on these threads. And thank you for talking about your book today. I really enjoyed reading it, and I hope the others will enjoy it too. Thank you for listening to today's episode, in which we explored Globalization Before Its Time, The Gujarati Merchant from Kutch, published by Penguin Books in 2016. This is your host, Ahmed Mazmi. Stay tuned for the next episode of New Books in the Indian Ocean World.